James chapter 1. Some of you may have had the experience of starting a new job and doing what they call growing into your role, which is code language for you have no idea what you're doing, and they just hope you figure it out. A long time ago, about 16 years ago, actually, I finished a grad degree in a field that I realized does not equate into an immediate job or a great job. And so it was music. And so when I got out, I did a series, went through like about a year. I was just kind of doing some odd jobs and things like that. And one of them, my favorite, was for the last several months of that period of time. I worked for a general contractor who did residential and commercial remodeling. And I told him at the beginning, I was like, I don't know anything, but I want to learn whatever you're willing to teach me. And he's like, okay, cool. So first day on the job, he hands me an electric drill and says, hey, I need you to go, like, do this thing. But you probably need to switch out the drill bit for a different size. So I'm like, okay, cool. So I go, and I'm, like, trying to figure it out, pressing buttons, trying to twist things. I'm like, oh, man. So I had to eat my pride and go back and say, hey, Nate, how do you switch this? And he's like, oh, you don't know how to work a chuck? And I'm like, who's Chuck? Like, we call this on-the-job training, right? And I actually did learn a lot from that job. It's a great way to grow, but it's also really humbling. And I think we'll see something similar in our text today in James 1. So James is writing an open letter to Jewish Christians scattered around the Roman Empire. His original readers, like us, experienced a variety of trials. That is, all sorts of difficult circumstances that tested the genuineness of their faith in Jesus. Remember, these people would have been expats. Many of them were rejected by their synagogues because they were Christians. Many of them, James says, were poor. And then they had the usual stuff, just the suffering that comes from living in a cursed, fallen world. And their pagan culture's constant pressure to conform. Worldliness, James calls it. And James says, through all of these things, God is cultivating endurance in you. An endurance that in time will produce you into a mature Christian, a little reflection of Jesus. And if you can zoom out and you see God's purpose in these trials, you see the long game, James says, you can actually greet these trials with joy. Nobody wants suffering, but as one of God's children, you do want maturity. And so someday in the future, when all is said and done, God will finish the work that he's begun in you, and you will be with him, secure, whole, and complete. And that steadies us. But what do we do in the meantime? For now, none of us is perfect, right? We're still in the middle of the trial. Maybe you're struggling to rejoice. Maybe the strain is exposing your own moral weaknesses. You're struggling with sin while you're struggling with the suffering. Maybe your faith is taking a beating and you don't know if you can keep going. If God is working endurance in you, you don't see it yet. And it feels like the worst kind of on-the-job training. Like, you know, I'm not even sure I've got what I need, but I got to keep on going anyway. And James is a wise and a gentle pastor, and he anticipates this. And that's, I think, what he's after in our text today. What do you do when you're still in the middle of the trial, and you're like, I'm not there yet, and man, I need help. So we're going to back up a little bit into the section that Brent preached last week, into verse 4. We'll start reading in verse 4. James says, so let endurance have its full effect, that you may, eventually, be perfect and complete, deficient in nothing. But if any of you is deficient in wisdom, he must ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him. But he must ask in faith, with no doubting, for the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea that is driven and tossed by the wind. For that person must not suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord. He is a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. Here's what I think James is after in a sentence. If you are struggling on the road to maturity, you need to ask God for wisdom. If you're struggling on the road to maturity, you need to ask God for wisdom. If you're going to see what God is doing in the trial, if you're going to faithfully walk through life that's marked by these kinds of tests, you're going to need something that you don't naturally have. You're going to need wisdom, and you're going to need God to get it. So let's unpack this text a little bit. First of all, at the beginning of verse 5, in the Greek, there's this little word that can be translated and or but. And it's omitted from a lot of translations. That's not a big deal, and I'm only mentioning it here because it signals to us that in James' mind, he's not just randomly starting some new topic. Okay, let's talk about wisdom. He's actually, in his mind, he's talking about the kind of wisdom that you need when you're weathering a test of your faith. James' first readers, being good Jews, would have been familiar with the book of Proverbs, and they knew that wisdom is knowing God and living skillfully in his world. And the Bible makes very clear throughout that we don't have that kind of wisdom naturally on our own. If we go it alone, things end badly, right? You know Proverbs 3, it says, trust in the Lord with all your heart and do not lean on your own understanding. It says, there's a way that seems right to a man, but the end of that is the way of death. Right? And in our more honest moments, we admit this to be true. We realize, especially for those of us who have been believers for a while, we could do testimony time. You know, times I didn't trust God and regretted it. It would be a long line in front of the mic, and it would go on for a long time. Okay, I would say, Sarah and I have told our kids before, like every time, as we look back in our lives, every time I didn't trust the Lord, I regret it. Like, we lack the wisdom that we need for life. So where are we going to get it then? James says, it's very simple. You ask for it. If any of you lacks wisdom, he must ask God. Proverbs 2 says, for the Lord gives wisdom. From his mouth come knowledge and understanding. There's this incredible passage in the book of Job where Job marvels at what people can do with mining technology, pulling precious metals out of the heart of the earth, in Job 28. And he says, it's like there's no limit to what humanity can accomplish through technology and science. You should read the chapter. It's incredible. It's like there's no limit, but there actually is limit. Job says, where shall wisdom be found? Like, you can't dig that up. You can't buy it. And Job says, God understands the way to wisdom, and he knows its place. Behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. So not only does wisdom come from God, it's also not just a set of facts that you can like upload into your brain. Real wisdom actually is something that comes from a right relationship with God. The way that you relate to God personally, he teaches you wisdom. And so we need, in our neediness, especially when going through trials, we need to go to God and ask him in faith. And to encourage us to ask, James brings up three things about God, if you look in verse 5. The first thing is that he says that God is a giver. Grammatically, it's like God is the giving God. It's literally in his nature that he loves to give. The second thing he says is that God gives sincerely. It's that word generously, which could also be translated single-heartedly, sincerely, without strings attached. You know, when you go to God and you ask for something, you have to like test the wind and kind of like feel him out. Like, how is his mood today? Like, maybe some of your elementary school teachers, like, is this a good day or a bad day? Is there some bizarre set of rules that you have to navigate with God when you make requests? Like, if any of you read Calvin and Hobbes, Calvin Ball, the rules are bizarre and completely impossible to predict, and you just don't know, the rules are always changing. Is God like that? You have some kind of like secret set of hoops that you have to jump through. And James says, no, God gives sincerely and simply and single-heartedly. Paganism has always been complicated and involved guessing, but the living God is not like that. So God is a giver, he gives sincerely, and third, God does not demean us for our neediness. God doesn't criticize us for asking for help. And maybe you've experienced that from people in your past. I'd just rather not ask. But I think James rightly senses that when we're struggling and we don't know what to do, we might think thoughts like this. We might think, well, this is partly or completely my fault that I'm in this trial. So I just got to suck it up and take it. Or maybe I just feel like a failure at the Christian life. I'm tired and I just want out. I can just see God scowling at me. Or maybe I've been a Christian for so long, I should be more mature than to be struggling right now. But James says, God will not shame you for your weakness. He's not going to chew you out when you plead for help. He wants you to ask. And so the result is that when we ask God for wisdom, God gives wisdom. Now, what does that mean? What does it mean that God gives wisdom? It means that God will help us know what to do and how to obey him, even when it's hard. It means that God will help us apply the truths of the Bible to our specific circumstance and know how to live skillfully in his world. I think it's important for us to note that God giving me wisdom does not mean that God will help me understand everything he's doing in my life, right? We'll understand it all better by and by, but not right now. God giving me wisdom does not mean that things will turn out ideally as I define them. Ideal, right? I won't necessarily get what I want. God giving wisdom doesn't necessarily mean that he'll erase all of my questions or my uneasiness. It also doesn't mean that God will beam wisdom into my head, okay, like magically, pow. If you read the book of Proverbs, what does the father tell the son is required to grow in wisdom? Searching, listening, practicing. So we will need to listen to God's word. We call it the ordinary means of grace. But when we're struggling under trials on the road to maturity, we need to ask God for wisdom, and he'll give it. But James, as he keeps going, he adds a caveat. And he says, you need to ask in the right way. He says, but let him ask in faith with no doubting. So then, what does it mean to ask in faith? If you recall, Jesus made some similar statements. He said things like, if you have faith and do not doubt, you will be able to move a mountain. And whatever you ask in prayer, you will receive if you have faith. It's Matthew 21. And so I think this raises an important question. Does asking God for wisdom, or does asking God for anything in faith, mean that we are certain God will give us what we're asking for? Does it mean that you have no hint of uncertainty about the outcome of your prayer? To quote Disney, does this mean if your heart is in your dream, no request is too extreme? Does it mean, to quote Disney again, who knows what miracles you can achieve when you believe, right? Does it mean like, I just got to convince myself it's going to happen and I just know it's going to happen, and then God will give it to me? No, and here's why. For one, I think we can assume that Jesus himself prayed to the Father in faith. And there's at least one prayer in the Garden of Gethsemane that Jesus prayed that the Father said no to. Likewise, I think the Apostle Paul, it's not clear that everything that he prayed for or hoped for or planned to do in his travel plans all came to pass. And if we're honest with ourselves, when we pray, we in fact do not know what God will do. One author said this helpfully, I think. He said, quote, a request of God must be made in faith, This could be understood to mean that it is up to believers to convince themselves that God will give them what they ask for and somehow to expunge all traces of uncertainty from their minds. But this kind of self-hypnosis is not what James is getting at here. The faith required for asking is trust in the character and promises of God, unquote. So praying in faith means approaching God as if he really is good, as if his promises are true, and that he can be trusted. On the other hand, the kind of doubting that James is talking about here implies questioning the very character of God. So it's all about how do we relate to God fundamentally. And this becomes clear in verses 6 through 8. James has four things to say about those who come to God doubting and what this kind of doubt that he's talking about looks like. First of all, he says, the person who doubts God is like white caps on the sea, or like the shape of the ocean. The shape of the ocean is always changing. It's not solid. It's always at mercy of other influences, like the wind. Second, he says, the person who doubts has divided loyalties. He calls them a double-minded man. They may come to God in their words, but something else secretly is ruling their heart. There's something else in the equation, kind of behind their back as they face God. Someone else really has their ear. There's some other criteria by which they are judging God and judging what God says, right? So they've got talking to God, and then they've got the other thing behind their back, or in an earpiece, as it were. And James says, that kind of doubt, doubting the character of God, makes you unstable. And the person who doubts like this will not receive God's wisdom or anything from God. Moses, in the book of Deuteronomy, is talking to the children of Israel, and he warned them against, you know, man, woman, or child who is listening today and would bless themselves in their heart and say, you know, I can ignore God's word. I can live by what I think is best, and it's going to be okay with me. That's Deuteronomy 29:19. That was the Ben translation. But you can look it up. Jeremiah 17 says, cursed is the person who trusts in man, who draws strength from mere flesh, and whose heart turns away from the Lord. That person will be like a bush in the wastelands. They will not see prosperity when it comes. They will dwell in the parched places of the desert, in a salt land where no one lives. But blessed is the one who trusts in the Lord, whose confidence is in him. They will be like a tree planted by the water that sends out its roots by the stream. It does not fear when heat comes. Its leaves are always green. It has no worries in a year of drought and never fails to bear fruit. And so it's not that the person of faith is, you know, strong and the doubter is weak. You'd say in this text, the person of faith is struggling to some degree. They're needy. They need wisdom. It's that both of them are relating to God in fundamentally different ways. One is approaching God as their only hope. They're all in. And the other person isn't convinced that God can be trusted. The way that we approach God reveals what we think about him. And so I thought of this illustration. It's probably a bad illustration, but here goes. Imagine that a dad takes his two sons to the state fair, right? And he says, all right, guys, go have fun. Okay, that's not probably a great parenting tactic, but he's like, sure, you just, you know, be back, check back in at noon, okay? And so, you know, son number one comes back a little while by himself, and he's like, hey, Dad, can I have ice cream? And the dad's like, oh, sure. Yeah, let's get ice cream. So he gets some ice cream, and that was great. And then he runs off again. And then 30 minutes later, son two comes up, tears, gritted teeth, and says, you got him ice cream and you didn't get me ice cream, and I wanted it and I'll never have it. And the dad's like, what? You know, he had his wallet, like he saw son coming, he had his wallet almost out of his pocket, and then that comes out and you're like, oh, wait a minute. What does the second son's words reveal about the way that he sees his dad? He sees his dad as unapproachable, stingy, and I had another word in there. Oh, well. He sees his dad as unapproachable and stingy, right? His words to his dad, the way that he approaches his dad, reflects how he sees his dad. And many of you, if your kids did that, you would be, like, internally a bit insulted, right? And I think it is true also that in our relationship with the Lord, the way that we approach God reveals something about the way that we see him. Jesus pictured faith as childlike, just asking and trusting. So I think James here is not adding on some extra requirement of asking. Like when you ask, okay, but you gotta like really mean it. It's not something you gotta work up. I think if anything, James is trying to say you need to strip away other things and get your request down to just asking. Just throw yourself on the generosity of God. God, he said, is a single-hearted giver. And so when you ask, you need to be a single-hearted asker. There's an author, A.W. Tozer, and he said this. Pseudo-faith, or fake faith, always arranges a way out to serve in case God fails it. Real faith knows only one way and gladly allows itself to be stripped of any second way or makeshift substitutes. For true faith, it is either God or total collapse. And not since Adam first stood up on the earth has God failed a single man or woman who trusted him. And so James says, when we are struggling on the road to maturity, we need to simply ask God for wisdom, and he will give it. I think James' tone in this passage is pastoral and comforting. He's saying, when our faith is being tried, what we desperately need is to believe what God says about himself. And when we do, we're going to ask and ask and ask. There's actually another Tozer quote. He said, what comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. And that's especially true when our faith is being tested. What do you think about God? So let me close this just a couple questions here. First, when you pray for yourself or other members of the church who are suffering, do you remember to pray for the state of their hearts and what that suffering is doing and how that suffering is tempting them and testing and trying their faith? Are you asking that the Lord would give them wisdom to see God's sovereign purpose in their lives, to make them like Jesus, wisdom to navigate the messiness and sometimes overlapping trials of life. Sometimes they come in stacks. And are you praying for them that they would turn to God simply and like a child in their need, trusting that God will give them what they need? This is where a lot of real spiritual battle in our church goes on. It's under the surface of suffering. And we need to be praying for one another. And then second of all, just a simple question that I kind of already alluded to earlier. Whether you're a member of our church or whether you're not even a Christian, I think this question applies to us. What thoughts about God keep you from trusting him? As we will remember in just a few moments, we recall the words of Romans 8:32. If God gave up his own son for us all on the cross, not for his own sins, for our sins, will he not with Jesus give us everything else we need? Right? God has proved his character to us definitively once and for all. And so when we are needy, we need to go to God and simply ask for grace in our time of need. Before we go to communion, I want to close with the words of Psalm 86:11, and it's brief, but I want this to be our closing prayer. Psalm 86:11 says this, "Teach me your way, O Lord, that I may rely on your faithfulness. Give me an undivided heart, that I may fear your name."